Welcome back to Following Know It On, a Stormlight podcast. This week is episode 192, and we're in chapters 3 through 9 of The Alloy of Law. Paul, how are you?
Marvelous. Excited to dive into a new series. It's the first time we've really been in a new series in a while. So,
Elliot?
I'm doing great. More Sanderson. Can't complain.
Sounds good. In your physical copy, you're reading instead of listening, Elliot, right?
Correct.
Are we halfway?
We are chapter 9? Just about halfway, I think.
Okay. We're only going to be doing 4 episodes on The Alloy of Law with no wrap-up episode. We will be jumping straight into Shadows of Self. Shadows for Self. Shadows of Self. I always get it wrong. And then we'll be wrapping up both of the first 2 books together in an episode after we're finished with the second book. So let's roll intro, and then we'll get a chapter summary from Elliot. All right, I'm going to throw it to Paul first. Paul, do we have a patron?
We do. We have I was scarred in the past, so I'm now very diligent to check and make sure I say the right thing. We have a new Ardent. Wonderful. We have a new Ardent this week, which I'm very happy to announce. And this one I can say. I feel like there's some wild names out there. I believe it is Siegfried. I really said I knew how to say it, but it's spelled wild, and my handwriting is horrible, so my apologies. Maybe we should have put this on someone else who has better handwriting. But
the charm.
I really appreciate the help, Siegfried, the support, as always. And so it's really great. And I feel like this is a fun time, you know, as we're starting Era 2, you know, having some new faces, some new patrons, new Ardents in the mix is always going to be helpful on the journey. So, thank you, Siegfried.
Thank you, Siegfried. All right, Elliot, what happens chapters 3 all the way to 9 of The Alloy of Law? Some pretty long chapters in this book, actually.
Some longer stuff, but it reads fast. That's for sure. It moves quite quickly. In chapter 3, Waxes, doing research about the robberies and the bandits that are out there, uncovers a little bit of information, and then spends a chunk of time praying to Harmony, which I actually found kind of fascinating, that segment there where he prays to Harmony. Chapter 4, he and Steris and Marassi and all of them head to the wedding. So they're at the wedding reception, and as they're about to go order their food, they realize that their server looks kind of familiar, and of course, it's Wayne. So Wayne has got another disguise going on and is impersonating a server at the wedding. So they chat about a lot of stuff. We learn that Marassi knows a lot more about crime and such things than maybe we would have guessed. She seems to be quite full of information. And then in chapter 5, the bandits arrive on the scene and bust in a whole bunch of them, whole army of them. I was expecting like 10, and we get like 37 bandits or something like that showing up. So pretty crazy. And yeah, things get a little bit violent. They bust in, they kidnap, or they attempt to kidnap Steris and Marassi. Wayne and Wax fight them off and take down quite a few of them. Some pretty fun action sequences through this. Some pretty cool Allomancy and Ferukemi going on here, which was pretty awesome. They take down quite a few, but the bandits do get away with Steris. So they've kidnapped Steris. Wax was able to save Marassi. Am I saying her name right, or do they say it differently in the audiobook?
They say it differently.
I'll chime in on this because it was bugging me. It's Marassi.
Marassi?
I'm always bad with... I believe that's how they say it.
Okay. Like, okay.
Marassi. Yeah.
Marassi. I will try to say that. I am bad with the emphasis sometimes. Marassi. Okay. Marassi. Wax is able to save her, so she's not kidnapped by the bandits. And then afterwards, they're just kind of digesting what's gone on. We get to chapter 7, which is actually a Marisi point of view, which was interesting. Get into her head a little bit. Wax is testing a bunch of alloys, trying to do research, figure out where we can go to track down these bandits and save Steris. Chapter 8 switches to a Wayne point of view, which was a pretty entertaining chapter as he infiltrates the police station and interrogates the captives and gets some information. And then in chapter 9, we're back to Marisi and Wax, and they're trying to decide what to do. Wayne comes back, and then Wax's butler tries to kill them all with not just poison, but a bomb as well. And they survive, I think.
He's got a gun, too.
That's where we close off. Gun as well?
Yeah. He tries to... Wayne sips the tea, says, tea's poisoned, and then falls over. And then the butler tries to shoot him first and then explodes himself.
Crazy. Can't trust anybody.
All right, Paul, you audiobook listener, you. Do you recognize the two voices that Michael Kramer uses for Wax and Wayne? Because I could not get this out of my head when I started this series for the first time.
So in previous... there's been previous times in the podcast that we've talked about Michael Kramer using similar voices for other things and potentially even being spoilers. And at that time, I was like, no. It never stuck out to me. I don't think that's a spoiler because I didn't notice, and I would apply that here. I have no idea what you're talking about. I'll be honest. No idea.
So when I started Mistborn Era 2, I had just reread the Stormlight Archive just like previously. I just finished Oathbringer. And then I started Wax and Wayne 1, and he uses the voice for Lopin as Wayne and the voice for Dalinar as Wax. So the entire time, I'm just envisioning Dalinar and Lopin having a conversation, and I cannot take anything. Not that you're supposed to take things super seriously in Mistborn Era 2, but like later on, as things do get more serious, I could not get on the same page because I was just envisioning Lopin and Dalinar sitting down trying to have a conversation, and it would just, you know. But that's an audiobook only feature. Elliot, you teased for Paul and me, that you have an engineering explanation segment for us, and I cannot wait any longer. So what is that about?
Ooh, okay. I gotta get into this. And it's been a long time since I've done one of these. So I'll apologize ahead of time for some boring math. We're going to get into some math. We're going to run through some equations. We're going to do some algebra here tonight on the Following Note on podcast. So brace yourselves. It'll be super quick, but I just thought it was fascinating and just had to dive into it because it tied into some of the stuff I get to do in my day job in engineering. So go ahead and open the image that I put in the Discord for you guys. And Trevor, I'm sure you can pull this up on the screen for our YouTube watchers. If you are just listening, I'll try to explain everything that's on this. But if you are curious, if this piques your interest at all, I would highly recommend hop on our YouTube for this episode and check out this picture that I'm showing you guys.
You there's a lot on here. Artwork too. Wow.
There's a lot on here. I did grab some artwork, so we'll need to credit the author. I did actually look it up, so I have a link for you, Trevor, on who did this artwork. Although I can't recall it off the top of my head, it was a really cool bit of artwork of Wax here flying through the air and dodging bullets and things. There's a lot of information on here, so I'm gonna talk you guys through it. But essentially, the genesis of this was, thinking back to last episode, some of the early chapters, we saw Wax scale up the skyscraper and then kind of jump off into the mists high above Ellendale, and he's flying along. And there's a moment where he turns around and uses his shotgun, fires a blast kind of away from him to propel him forward and do this big old, you know, Mistborn jump through the air using his shotgun as propulsion. And once we talked about that on the podcast, the lightning bolt struck me of, wait a second, we could do some math on this and answer a few questions that I have. And The bottom line for this is essentially what Wax is doing is he's got a handheld rocket. A rocket is nothing else than a device that pushes a small amount of matter really fast that way so that you can push yourself, the larger matter, the other direction. And that's exactly what he's doing with the shotgun here. So we can crunch some equations on this. Ultimately, what I wanted to try and figure out is in order to do this, Wax has to reduce his weight drastically. He's got his ferrochemie ability where he can do this, right? He can fill his metal mines and become super lightweight. Well, instantly I thought, well, how light does Wax have to be? Because my gut was telling me really light. Like if you're a 175 pound male and you try and use a shotgun to blast yourself through the air, you're going to go about a quarter of an inch, maybe. Wax, I, at least in my mind, is flying like 10, 20, 30, 40 feet through the air. So we need to get to Epic. How light does Wax have to be in order to get to Epic jump through the mist with a shotgun? You guys follow me so far?
Yes.
Okay. On my picture here, I've divided into four quadrants, 1, 2, 3, 4. Top left, quadrant one shows the range equation. So if we want to know how far something flies in the air, we know how fast it's moving. We could use that equation that you see right there to calculate it. So we need a couple things. We need the acceleration of gravity, which is the force pulling you down. We need the angle at which you're trying to fly, which if you're Wax, the optimal angle you want to go with is 45 degrees. Anything shallower or steeper, you're not quite going to go as far. So I'm assuming Wax knows this and he's aiming exactly 45 degrees. Hopefully he did that. Then I'm going to plug in some numbers for how far he might go. So let's assume two cases. First is maybe 10 feet. He flies 10 feet. Second case is maybe he flies 50 feet. That's what I really want him to do, is be able to actually shoot himself through the air and, you know, fly across the city with that. So we're going to assume 50 feet for that. So if you plug in 10 feet into that equation, you get that he needs to launch at a velocity of 18 feet per second. That's just plugging all those numbers into that range equation that you see. So bottom left in my quadrant two, you see these numbers. In order to go 50 feet, he needs to be able to shoot himself at 40 feet per second. That's pretty fast. So he's got to be able to go 40 feet per second off of this shotgun that he's shooting in order to go 50 feet through the air. Just classic physics. One thing I should point out at this point, I am assuming that the gravity on Skadrill is the exact same as Earth.
Which it is.
A little bit of research told me that it is. Now, not true on other Cosmere planets, right? We've got a wide variety of different sizes of Cosmere planets. But what I was able to look up is that Skadrill is supposed to be the most Earth-like of the Cosmere. So
at this point, yes. Maybe previous versions, not so much.
Sure. So I'm assuming that the gravity on Skadrill is an accelerating force of 32 feet per second squared, which is what it is on Earth. Okay, so we have our speed. We know how fast Wax needs to go. Now we switch over to my favorite equation in the existence of math, the rocket equation. So the rocket equation is in the top right of this, third quadrant. The rocket equation tells you that if you know your mass when you started and your mass when you finished doing your rocket burn, basically how much mass did you push in the other direction? So what was the difference in your mass? The velocity of the exiting mass that you're shooting the other way, which in this case is his bullet, right? So he's got a shotgun. He's going to point the other way. He's going to shoot it. We need to know how much mass did he leave behind and how fast did that mass go? And that's going to tell us how fast it's going to push him in the other direction. Now there's a Greek letter in here, delta. So the rocket equation gives you a delta V, but for our instances here, it's pretty simple. I'm assuming he's not moving to start with. So from zero velocity to whatever velocity he needs to get to, that's our delta V. It's essentially the same velocity as what we just had on the other side. So I can take my scenarios I did in the bottom left. To go 10 feet, I need 18 feet per second. Okay, so we just take 18 feet per second and plug that into the rocket equation. And that tells us Wax has to reduce his mass all the way down to 12 pounds. Or for anyone in the metric system, that's 5.5 kilograms. Wax has to weigh 12 pounds in order to go 10 feet with his rocket blast. That's pretty light. He's got to really reduce his mass down pretty far. And if he wants to go 50 feet, which is what I really want him to do, he's got to go all the way down to 5.5 pounds or 2.5 kilograms. And I'll note, this is everything on him. This is his guns, his jacket, his boots, his pants, his hair. Everything he is has to get down to 5.5 pounds in order to make that 50-foot jump possible. So there you go. If Wax is blasting himself through the air, he's got to really pour into those metal mines and get super light. Seems, I don't really want to go into like the borderline impossible side of things, but I don't know. I don't know. A lot of manipulation going on here.
I think this has been my favorite Elliot engineering moment. It's just really satisfying to see that you took the time to calculate the rocket equation of Waxillium. I just think that's awesome.
Okay. And if I were now Sanderson, answering your question of this is not feasible, Brandon Sanderson, I would then respond with, do you remember those super iconic but not super, what's the word I'm looking for? Functional mist cloaks from Era 1 and why they're like all tatters and strands and not much substance to them?
Mm-hmm.
This is why, because he knew in Era 2 he was going to have to reduce his weight to 5.5 or kilograms or whatever to shoot himself across the sky. I'm just kidding. you're assuming that he's not also steel pushing off the bullet, correct?
That is true. I am assuming he is not steel pushing off the bullet. That would be another change to this. The other thing that I'm not including in this is a question that I have, which is his ferrochemi truly reducing his mass, or is it affecting the pull of gravity on him? Because mass and weight are different things. And the book usually uses the term weight, but when most people use the term weight, they're talking about mass. And so if we, you know, think about Roshar and Kaladin and Zeth, I think they're influencing the force of gravity on them with their lashing. So I don't know if Wax is doing that or if he's truly reducing his mass, which would change the math on this.
Once again, they ask Wax this question later, so I will not answer it yet.
I'm excited for that. Maybe you'll get a rocket equation 2.0 if I have to go back and update this for any information we learn later.
One last question about this rocket equation, and I think I already know the answer, because we're assuming all of like normal Earth things, right? All normal Earth stuff. But my question, and I feel like if I were playing what Trevor did earlier, and I was like, I'm Sanderson, and I'm explaining why this can still work or whatever, is what if the gun is just more powerful than a shotgun that you have here? You know, it's
possible.
It's like a good step more. There's more gunpowder, whatever, bigger explosion, more firepower, you know, yada, yada. I feel like that would, in my head, is the most logical.
Bigger.
It was just a bigger rocket launch. So
bigger gun would help for sure. I did not include in this air resistance though, and that would work the other way. That would make this even harder, is he's got to push himself through the air. And so he probably honestly has to be even lighter than the numbers that I've got here, which maybe that's totally possible. Maybe he really can dump all his weight into the metal mine and get all the way down to 5 pounds or whatever it is. But that's what he's got to do if he wants to go sailing across the town.
I like where your guys' brains are at, because Sanderson, when he's writing this, also has his brain in the same spot, because we also get to more powerful guns push you further. Like we answer some of those questions later in this series. So I'm excited to get into this. Okay. Last week I intended to bring this up, but I forgot. The map of Elendil and the surrounding basin. I want to talk about this. So we talked a little bit about how Scadrial, after what they call the Catasandra, which is Sazed remaking the world, he basically makes a utopia for Elendil and the main city of Elendil. So if you look at this map, I'll put it up on screen for our YouTube viewers as well. You have Elendil, which is in the center of this circle or semicircle of mountains. And then outside of the mountains, it says the Northern Roughs, the Southern Roughs. And there's some railroad tracks on the map as well. So if you'll notice, Elendil's right in the center of it, and all of the railroad tracks lead straight to Ellendale, right? There's none in between different little cities. They're all going to Ellendale and then back out from it. So, I believe there's a map as well. The rivers do the same thing. The rivers all flow straight to Ellendale and out into the Sea of Yeomind. And I don't know if they talk about this specifically. I don't remember. But Sazed specifically did this as he made the world. He created like a Garden of Eden for humans to recuperate for the next however many hundreds of years to try to revive and give humans a break from after what they've been through. So everything that's in Ellendale Basin in this map here, think like the best farmland you could ever have, really fertile soil, really good crops, that type of thing. That's the entirety of the Ellendale Basin. And then outside of that, you get some more Wild West, like either deserty or more highland desert type terrain that's in the roughs. And then out beyond that, there's more desert. And they haven't mapped out there, at least in this book one yet. And then the mountains, have snow and ice in them as well. So I just thought that was a cool touch to include in this book, is that as Sazed remade the world, he created like this little Garden of Eden. It's not little. This massive Garden of Eden basin for humanity to like recover in. I thought that was pretty cool.
I agree with that. And I know we've mentioned briefly before, but it looks like a lot of the towns and notable places are names of our previous characters in Era 1, which I think is a really neat little homage, I guess, to Era 1.
Yeah.
And I've definitely caught on to that our characters, our heroes in the first series are like legends of old. You know, they talk about, I forgot how they refer to Vin, but as like
the Ascended Warrior.
Yeah, the Ascended Warrior, that's what it is. And things like that. And it's neat. It's neat to kind of have that and know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah. We get a couple more of those name drops or title drops. We get the Words of Founding, which is that book or those books that Sazed left for Spook to find in the meadow at the end of the Hero of Ages. We have the Originators, which is the title for that original generation that came out of the ground after the Hero of Ages. We have the Lord Mistborn. As Wax is doing some research and figuring out that all of these ladies that have been kidnapped can directly trace their lineage back to the Lord Mistborn. And originally when I heard that, I thought that they were talking about Elend. Elend is the one who came to my brain when the Lord Mistborn was mentioned. But it's actually Spook. Elend and Vin didn't have any kids. Spook presumably did. And so the Lord Mistborn is actually Spook, which I think is actually pretty cool.
I actually wrote that in my notes to ask you about that, because I did the same logic process of originally I was thinking Elend as well. And then later on I realized, well, wait a second, the only Mistborn that I think we know of that was alive at the end of the previous books was Spook. So I actually wrote that down, which now makes me really intrigued to know, what did Spook do in those next few years to establish himself as the Lord Mistborn?
Yeah. Elliot, you mentioned this in your summary. Wax has a moment in chapter 3, I believe, where he stops and prays to Harmony. And he gets like subtle impressions of like amusement and humor and stuff like that, and he doesn't know if what's actually happening. What notes did you take on that?
I took a few. I thought it was fascinating how, if for whatever reason, maybe you picked up this book and you hadn't read Mistborn Era 1, or maybe it'd been a really long time and you didn't remember exactly what was going on, you would take this scene extremely differently. When he goes to pick up the earring, and just what seems to him like maybe just a kind of a spiritual ritual, puts the earring in to then start praying. As soon as he puts that earring in, I'm like, oh, wait a second, I know what's going on here. We've seen spiked individuals commune with those in the cognitive realm. And so that makes perfect magical sense in this world of put the earring in, that keys you into actual Harmony or Kelsey or whoever it is you're trying to talk to. And so when the scene kind of talks about, and he felt vaguely this kind of impression after saying the words, I completely inserted my right there as that's Seiza and Harmony, you know, speaking ish directly to him. So it was pretty cool.
Prediction from both of you. How involved is Seiza going to be in this series?
I think classic Sanderson, book one, not at all. Book two, a tiny bit. Book three, a lot more. Book four, a ton.
It's a safe bet. Paul?
I would echo that. I agree and have similar thoughts. I guess my amendment will be how involved. It is different because starting era one, I feel like there was in the back of my mind, there's like, okay, when are we going to learn about the troublesome shards, you know, in the background, you know, the ruin, the whatever, you know? And here I'm like, is this troublesome? We know Sazed is a great guy. And so, and it sounds like ruin and preservation are now Harmony, which sounds really positive to me. So I'm like, is there going to be a dilemma with that? Or are we just going to see a more zoomed in story, I guess? I have, with any of these series, I can't help but feel that it is going to zoom out and get to a bigger Cosmere level. But I don't know. I don't know how, I can't foresee how that will be. But I would guess that Harmony is, I would say that he's definitely involved. Like notably involved, and we may just not see it for a while. So,
I guess you guys are cheating because you went to the release party of the Lost Metal. So maybe you have a little bit more insight.
I feel like I don't actually know anything from that. All I know about Lost Metal is that it's like the biggest Cosmere crossover book that Brandon Sanderson said, like, I don't care anymore. I'm going to do whatever I want. And so I feel like that's my only knowledge of it. Which is fair. Maybe that's notable. I have no ideas what that could mean, but we'll see.
All right, Elliot, you have a couple terms that you have questions on the outline here. Sliverism. Where did we see Sliverism come in here? I believe Steris is the one who mentions it.
I think Steris mentions it, and I think she mentions it about the Yeomans.
Yeah. And
the Yeoman family, they follow Sliverism, which little physical book nuance, a little bit of OCD kicked in, and I totally read it as Silverism the first time, probably the first two times I read it. And then finally came back and was like, wait, that doesn't say silver, it says sliver. So Sliverism. And then kind of in the same conversation, she drops a reference to Iron Eyes himself. So hard to quite piece together the bits, but maybe Sliverism is worshiping Iron Eyes, whoever that is.
Is this our first mention of Iron Eyes?
They've used it as like a curse up until now. It's been, Iron Eyes take you, or I'll send you to see Iron Eyes kind of thing.
So, yes, Iron Eyes has been used as a curse so far, but he's been mentioned once already in the prologue. The prologue, the crazy guy, what's his name?
Tan or something like that?
Yeah, Bloody Tan. He said, I've met God and I've met Iron Eyes and death and life. And he kind of like mix and matches the two, or maybe like uses them as synonyms.
Yep.
Or does he? Like, are those two different people? Are they the same people? Who's he talking to or about? So any predictions? I mean, there's two obvious candidates based on the knowledge you two have. What would the two most obvious candidates be for Iron Eyes?
Well, I mean, Iron Eyes seems like a clear reference to anybody that's got big old hemorrhagic spikes in their eyes. So we've seen Inquisitors do that. So maybe this is a new Inquisitor. I'm assuming that, I'm trying to remember back to the end of Hero of Ages. I'm assuming that Seiza didn't leave any of the Inquisitors around when he remade the world and they were all left dead, but maybe that's incorrect. We've mm-hmm. got a slight suspicion based on information that we've gathered from other sources that we expect uh-huh. Kelsier to show up at some point with one spike in an eye. So aside from that, where do you go with that prediction? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I don't know if I know for sure on this. I can't help but think that they're... Well, you see, this is very complicated, Trevor. So
yes.
Because I'm like, okay, I don't think they're... Like, okay. I don't think any of the Inquisitors from Era 1 are still here. But I'm like, are there still Inquisitors? I feel like, I mean, I don't think there are. I'm wrestling with a lot of things right now as I think through this. All in all, to answer your question, I don't have a great guess. I'm like, Iron Eyes, is that Kelsier? I don't know. Kelsier, we just haven't seen him yet. That's my only guess. I don't think we're going to have Inquisitors in here as we knew them before. Because Inquisitors were very driven by ruin and ruination. And I don't know, is Harmony, as he's known, is he holding two shards still independently of ruin and preservation? Or is it now one singular Harmony? If it is one singular Harmony, then I would say no, there's not an Inquisitor. If it is both preservation and ruin, which I don't think it is, then I'm like, I mean, there could be an Inquisitor, right? There could be a guy out there that says it wanted to have a spike in. I don't know. Something like that.
So we know that Kolos exist, or at least we've heard mention of them. And based off of that alone, I'm ready to conclude that it's possible to have an Inquisitor. And are they the exact beings with the same purpose and mind control that we saw in Era 1? Probably not. But could somebody in the last 300 years have discovered, oh, if I stab that Allomancer through the heart into me, I gain their powers and create new Inquisitors? That seems very feasible to me.
The where is the hemallergy question is an interesting one. That's a number one I had on my list. I remember as a first reader, I was like, all right, where's the Inquisitors? I know they're here somewhere. Little did I know. All right. The wedding, or somebody random's wedding that they go to. This is like the first public appearance of Wax and Steris. And they turn some heads. People are noticing that they're a couple. As they come in, there's some light banter between Wayne when he shows up, and then, you know, Wax and Steris's father kind of go back and forth. Like he's trying to, you know, get to know the father-in-law, get on good terms with Steris and her family. And Steris's father appreciates some of Wax and Wayne's crass jokes. They talk about like tough life in the roughs and come up with some crude jokes. Is that type of banter and joke landing for you guys in this series so far, or is it like just moving on? I don't care about your stupid sixth grade jokes, Brandon.
I would say it's landing. It's not like, I think it's almost how I view Wayne different than I view like Lopin.
Okay.
For example, of another like character that's just largely wrapped up in ridiculousness and jokes and levity and things like that. I like Wayne more, I guess. I don't know. I think the 1-to-1 ratio makes it very funny to me, or makes it better to me. Whereas, like, if you have a member of a large group like Lopin, like a member of Bridge 4. I don't know. I feel like he's more of like the, okay, there's a lot of cool stuff going on with these other characters. And so Lopin brings funny moments, but I'm like, okay, but I'm here for the other stuff, you know? And I feel like the more one-to-one of Wax and Wayne being together, so far I've enjoyed it. It's not like I'm like, whoa, I'm rolling on the floor laughing, but it's pretty good. It's not landing, but
okay,
nothing I've written home about, I guess.
I think it's working for me, and I'm helped by a rather interesting fact in that when we first started reading, like the very first 2 days of reading this book, my book had not actually arrived in the mail. It was still in the mail. So I just for like one day borrowed the audiobook from the library. And so I listened to like the first chapter and a half on the audiobook just to stay caught up. And Michael Kramer's delivery of the banter was really good. The Wax and Wayne interactions, or the little bits that I got there, he sold it. Michael Kramer sold it really well. And so I now have kind of his delivery in my mental voice that I'm reading through these. And that helps a lot with some of the childish or immature moments that they're going through. Is I can imagine a well-delivered version of that. If it was not well-delivered, then it would fall a little flat for me. But kind of setting the stage with a good comedic delivery helped me a lot.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I think I agree. All right, so the bandits show up. They don't shoot up the place. They want to shoot up the place, and Wax and Wayne can kind of see that. And so right before the bandits are about to leave, they take Steris and Marisee as hostages, which is supposed to be random, but in the chapter beforehand, they had targeted that it's not random. The hostages are strong likelihood to be Allomancers, and they're female. And it's not till after this banquet that Maris, he's actually the one that puts it together. She comes to the conclusion that the bandits may be not kidnapping an Allomancy army, but breeding an Allomancy army, which extremely dark and an extremely long game. Like that's not an average thug thing to do, like steal your riches and go home. No, that's like in 35 years we're gonna have all the Allomancers. Like what did you guys think of that?
I thought back to Era One and the Lord Ruler kind of doing the opposite, right? The Lord Ruler bred humans to try and get Ferukemi eradicated. And this seems an interesting parallel of some big bad villain is gathering up Allomancers to breed more Allomancers to create an army or control all the magic wielders, whatever you want to say. It makes sense in some aspects. It has other logistical challenges, like you just pointed out, Trevor, in others.
I thought this was a bit funky. It's like, okay, I you know, the big master plan being, I mean, I understand having a long range, you know, distant vision for a plan, but it felt weird. I feel like this isn't the actual like problem at hand. That there's something else. Maybe this is what's going on. They're trying to breed for Allomancy, but I don't know. I guess I also think that isn't actually the thing. I feel like this is a red herring.
Okay, so not to make it even more dark, but where my brain went when I first read this was, okay, so you have an Allomancer. Is there a more immediate use of their power besides brainwashing them and making them grow up and serve you?
Hemallergy.
Yeah. What if they are trying to breed Allomancers for hemallergical purposes?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty dark.
That's pretty dark. So, which one is it, Brandon? Are we lighthearted and Wild West, or are we like, you know, go back to Mistborn Era 1? Which one are we doing?
Yeah, those are...
That does make a huge difference, doesn't it? Yeah.
Those are the questions.
Okay, so Steris is taken. Mercy is not taken. And apparently Mercy's like a crack shot. Like, she can snipe thugs from across the ballroom in with like this random rifle that she was given. Like, where did that come from? That's crazy.
She's part of her like college's university's gun club or something. Isn't that what she says? Like the ladies, yep. Ladies gun club. Yeah.
It even got to the point by the end of probably chapter 6, I think. That's where all the action's happening. That I was starting to get awfully suspicious. She knows a lot about law and legal issues and crime fighting and crime itself. She just spouts off random statistics all the time. She all of a sudden is wicked good with a rifle. I was about ready at the end of chapter 6 to chalk her up as like inside man. You know, Mercy is going to be the villain, or at least wildly not who we think she is by the end of this. And then to throw a wrench in my prediction, chapter 7 opens with a Mercy POV, which felt like strong indication that she would not be some kind of a surprise twist villain if we're getting to see inside her head a little bit. So I'm not quite sure where to go with that, but maybe I'll just back it off to there's more about Mercy than we know so far.
Okay, Elliot, I'm glad you mentioned this because, okay, while I'm not certain, and I feel silly because I know that there was a point while I was reading, maybe one of the, I think it had to have been the last two chapters we read, somewhere in chapters 8 and 9, there was a moment that I thought, and I was like, okay, I think the twist of this is that Mercy is going to be an inside job, like some kind of deceiver, you know, something like that. It just feels too weird. It is neat. So what I'm going to just talk about things I know about Mercy. We get I'm saying this also to point out that there's one of two things that I think can happen. One is what we just said, like she's secretly a bad guy. Second is we see that she like really has an admiration for Wax, like has big admiration, right? And so it's like it seems like it's set up to be like a love interest potentially, like not right now, but like, you know, down the road maybe they'll fall in love. And I think that's a really funny dichotomy. Either they're actually enemies, or maybe they'll fall in love, you know. But I'm like also, I guess a point towards the evil side. If she has this fascination with Wax, then, you know, doesn't that make her a good... She could either be, like, secretly evil, or she could be getting exploited or something like that. Like, she's been pseudo a target for kidnapping, right? I guess, like, maybe she's being forced to get inside information. Maybe she doesn't want to. I don't know what motives. Obviously, we don't know anything here. But I don't know. The more I say it, I'm like, maybe I'm convinced. Maybe Mercy is just bad, and I need to start only thinking of her through that lens. I think I'm ready to do that. I'm going to do that for the next episode, and we'll see where that gets me.
I mean, isn't it classic bad guy tactic? Insert the inside man, get the inside man liked by all the good guys, or kind of, you know, get on the inside, and then bad guys bust in, kidnap somebody, and conveniently also kidnap the inside man so that they shift the suspicion off of her, and then, oh, she gets saved, and she's back with the good guys. Now we can really trust her. It's a classic, right?
That's a great point. I feel bad. The last thing I want to say, and this isn't really anything at all, is I need to go reread chapters 8 and 9 or something, because I know that there was something some little piece of dialogue, which I probably was reading way too much into, that made me think this. And not enough to where I wrote it down, because obviously I didn't write it down, or else I would have remembered this, what I was thinking of. But there's something that made me think that. And so I'm glad you mentioned this, Elliot, because that reminded me. So
the other bit of relevant information we learn in chapter 9 is that we discover that Marcy is apparently the illegitimate child of Lord Harms, and that she is not Steris's cousin. She's Steris's half-sister.
Secret half-sister, yep.
Yeah.
This was interesting also because it gives some more insight to Steris, who was a bit off-putting, I feel like, as you meet Steris. It's very off-putting. It's very rigid. We're going to have this marriage for political reasons, and here's the clause about you taking mistresses if you want, and me as well. You know, like that thing. And then they kind of mention, as this is revealed, that maybe that was a thing in her mind because that's kind of the environment she grew up in. And so I thought that was interesting as well. So,
chapter 9, the butler tries to blow them up. We should have done a spell check on this guy, I think. So, Elliot, do you want to try to say that name? Or did we say it last week? Did we say it last week?
I don't think we did. I don't know that I do. I think it was in one of the early chapters that I listened to on audiobook, but I don't remember it. It's a strange one. French, maybe? I don't even know. Talome?
They say it. It's spelled Tillaume, but they say it Tiome.
Tiome.
Huh. They skip the L's, and it's like the way they pronounce it is Tiome. Tiome.
Okay.
But not that he's super relevant anymore, because he has committed suicide and tries to blow up our heroes. What do you guys think of, because they use this in this scene as well, what do you guys think of speed bubbles? They seem awfully handy to our heroes to be able to spout some dialogue in the middle of an action sequence for our amusement and then continue on their action sequence.
I liked this scene because it answered some questions for me. So Wayne mentions in this speed bubble, he's like, okay, I'm talking to you, and this is okay for me to be talking to you. However, please don't move, because then they'll see a blur and they'll know, there are some flaws, if minorly. Like, the speed bubble seems very powerful. Like, it seems quite ridiculously, like, abusable. I mean, a situation like this is, like, so crucial to get to have a full-length conversation and explain things to a hostage while you're being held hostage, like all this stuff. Like, it's absolutely crazy. But I feel like one thing that was added as a limitation here is Wayne mentions, and I don't know if this is just his character or how true this is, but he needs bend alloy, and it sounds like bend alloy is pretty expensive. Not like ATM in Era 1, but like, not even close to that, I imagine. But like, you know, a precious, maybe not precious, but expensive. Like, you can't just willy-nilly always have speed bubbles all the time, always have plenty of bend alloy. It sounds more difficult. And so I wonder if that will become a limitation in the future. But yeah, but as far as like the ability itself, it seems incredibly impactful and helpful. This is probably a conversation for a later time, but I'm like, could you have a speed bubble on another planet? Because that could change a lot of how I might think of different scenarios. I don't know. So anyways.
My question is, let's say you're in a carriage, right? A moving carriage with a horse. And you pop a speed bubble and your horses aren't in the speed bubble. What happens?
I mean,
I think there's a lot of questions about the speed bubbles. Are like, let's say Wayne pops one in the middle of the street so he can have a conversation, and but someone else is really close to it. So even though they're moving slowly, they still like break the plane of it. You know, what happens then if you like accidentally walk into somebody's speed bubble while they're speed bubbling?
Yeah, I don't know.
It almost feels like a fourth wall break to me. It's a wait, quick pause. Let's talk about this.
Yeah.
And they like can pause in the middle of the action scene, talk about and strategize what they're going to do. And then, okay, unpause, go. It almost feels like a stage play kind of thing.
That's an interesting point. I didn't think about that, but you're kind of right. One thing I'm thinking, and this is maybe back to Trevor's scenario. I don't know. I feel like the speed bubble is so like, could be wrong. Actually, unironically, if you think of something that's wrong in this, let me know, because I want to make sure I understand the speed bubble right. But my understanding of it is like, okay, you activate the speed bubble, there's a bubble around you, and depending on how much bend alloy you use or whatever, varies in size. Anyone in the speed bubble with you is in the speed bubble, and now on this speed bubble time, not real time, if you will. My question with this is, my understanding is the people outside the bubble don't ever really even know that the bubble has happened because it's over in like an instant in real time.
Right.
It's like maybe a Narnia thing, you know, like go to the wardrobe, spend a full day there, come back, it's been like 10 minutes, you know, or, you know, but even more like dramatized in a shorter increment of like people outside the speed bubble don't even know it's happened, but it has happened, you know. And so I'm like, your horse example, the speed bubble would have happened in the blink, in like a minuscule fraction of a second. The horses would never even know. They would have kept going and it would have made no difference, you know, right?
Okay.
That's my thought. But I could be wrong on how I would fully believe if I'm missing a detail of this, because it is a new concept to me.
No, I understand what you're saying. Specifically from the perspective of outside the speed bubble, it's really hard to interact with it because it goes so fast. Yeah. And in the wedding sequence, we see it like it has flaws, right? Because the bandits figure out that he's using speed bubbles and then start shooting like within 5 or 6 feet of him on either side so that he can't really dodge. Like they kind of just spray in his general area and he does end up getting hit. But Wayne's two abilities together are actually pretty cool because he can trap only himself in a speed bubble and then give himself time to heal off his ferrochemical abilities and then drop the speed bubble and he's healed from his gunshot wound. So as long as he has the space and doesn't like catch other people in speed bubbles, I mean, as long as he doesn't run out of bend alloy, which you mentioned it was pretty expensive. Yeah, I think that is true. I think bend alloy is pretty expensive on the planet, which is an interesting caveat.
It did occur to me that it's a very painful way to fight.
Yeah,
Wayne's. It's, hey, I'm going to take you all down, but I'm going to do it just by taking a lot of damage and healing from it as I go.
Yeah,
you still got to take all that damage and all those hits, and it feels like he's going to be constantly getting shot up every time we run into a bunch of bad guys. I think I'd rather have Wax's powers.
Yeah, okay, rocket engineer.
The one thing, this is a slight side note, but so we don't know all of the like, okay, so we knew the names for coin shots, lurchers, thugs, you know, stuff like that in Mistborn Era 1. Terms for allomancers or mistings that have one allomantic power. This whole twinborn thing opens up a lot of names. They've mentioned some names, right? And a lot of different combinations. And I haven't gone down the rabbit hole yet, but like I feel like I need to pull up a list of the like different powers or whatever and all the combinations you have. I bet there's some really wacky stuff, you know. I think of some of the like really rejected like superheroes, like Marvel superheroes that like have the weirdest power and you're like, okay, Matter Eater Lad, which was a real superhero comic. Like this isn't gonna go too well. And I feel like Wayne got a very unique set of skills, I guess. You know,
they call Wax a crasher, which is a combination of coin shot and weight ferrochemist. And there's an offhand comment of, you know, Wayne claims to have memorized all the titles for all the different combinations. But if there's 16 allomantic powers and 16 ferrochemical powers, somebody do the math for me. What is that? 16 squared?
Yeah, I think so.
That's a lot. That's a lot of different. That's a lot of different titles, combinations you could have.
This is why the Copper Mind exists, so that we can document and discuss and debate and go read about all these things.
Both in-world and for us. Okay, anything else for 3 through 9? Wax, like, maybe might recognize the bandit leader?
Yeah.
But he doesn't like expand upon it. He's just like, is that who I think it is? And then he shoots him in the face and then he's gone. And then that's it.
He thinks the voice sounds familiar. That's how it starts, right? He's like, I know that voice. But then he, in the midst of it all, shoots the guy and he goes down. And then he thinks to himself, oh, okay. Can't be Miles, because Miles is twin born and he doesn't say what powers he has, but he basically alludes to there's no way he would go down if he was shot if he was Miles. But then later, I think after the fact, he realizes that Miles, that the bandit leader, is nowhere to be found. So clearly he either got dragged off by his buddies or got up and left. And so now Wax is like, oh, wait a second. Could it have been this Miles guy?
Does he say who Miles is? Does he give a background on Miles?
He knew him out in the roughs. He's mentioned him several times as an old buddy or lawman. I think when Wayne first shows up, he's like, Wayne, I thought I put you in charge. And Wayne's like, oh, no, it's fine. I left Miles in charge, or something like that.
Okay.
That's what I was thinking. And Wayne seems to not mind Miles, but Wax seems to not like him, from my understanding. And you're right. They have mentioned his name several times. I've been very curious to meet Miles, because I don't have a clear picture of if he is actually good or bad. He sounds like an old friend kind of thing, a fellow constable, if you will. And but it seems like there's some disdain, some weird stuff. So yeah.
Sounds good. Anything else?
Quick rabbit trail on some more alloys. When Wax is doing research after all this goes down at the wedding feast, he's trying to figure out maybe if he can determine exactly what kind of alloy the gun is made out of, and then he can maybe track them down. They know it's aluminum, but he figures out it's actually an alloy of aluminum. And Brandon drops another name for a new metal. Wax says, oh, it's aluminum, but I'm pretty sure it's a alloy. I think it's been mixed with ecaboron. And my brain instantly casts back to high school chemistry, and I'm like, ecaboron, that's not on the periodic table. What are you
trying to do to me here, Brandon? I would recognize
that. And boron is, but ecaboron, not a thing. But I've learned my lesson. Brandon does his research. So quick little Google search on ecaboron. It absolutely is a thing. Ecaboron was an early name for scandium, which is another element on the periodic table. So yeah, I'm not super familiar with what scandium is, but go pull up your periodic table of elements, and it's on there as one of the lesser known metals out there in the world. And sure enough, a scandium aluminum alloy is absolutely a thing. And guess what? It can be used to make firearms in the real world.
Wow.
Wow.
So Brandon did it the other way. He Googled Bio-Arm making aluminum with or alloy with aluminum, uh-huh. and he came up with that. So then you went uh-huh. the other direction. I was like, okay, what is this? And did it backward. That's funny.
And he tried to hide it slightly by not just calling it scandium. He's like, oh, what's another name for scandium? Oh, okay. Back when the scientist first discovered it, he originally called it ecaboron. So, boom, there it is.
So I've gotten in, you know, physics, engineering-ish lesson to start, and then a chemistry lesson. You know, we just need biology next week and astronomy, and then.
Hey, you know. Careful what you wish for with a biology lesson. Our chondra are still missing.
That's Ooh. True. Chondra, colos. Yeah, there's mm-hmm. a lot of stuff. You know, we've talked about that before. So I'm feeling good about my degree plan. I think I'm going to have some great educational, you know.
Going to graduate a year early.
Yeah, exactly. I'm Dual on major. The fast track, apparently. Yeah.
All righty. We can close it there and go for a Stormlight review unless you guys have something else.
I think we hit all the big stuff.
All righty. We will be reading, I actually don't know, 10 through 14 next week. Let me go. Hold on. 10 through 14. I was right. 10 through 14 for next week, and then 15 through the epilogue for the week after. For our Stormlight review, gentlemen, Paul is going to lead this. Paul, you are trailing 7-5. You are 2 points behind, well within striking distance. For your chapter name, you need to give me a brief description or a brief summary of what happened in the chapter, and I'm going to give you the name. Kata. And based on Elliot's facial expression over there, you do have to be quite specific with this one.
Oh, uh-oh. Okay. I could get it generically. Specific, maybe not.
This is the Kaladin chapter. I'm kidding.
You're correct.
I'm not kidding that it is a Kaladin chapter, but I was joking as in being very vague. Okay, this is... We've already done the one where it was their training, part of their training sequence in the... In the chasm. So I don't think it's that. I'm trying to think of the other times we've had the kata. I think this is... Isn't this the scene, the chapter where Moash and Kaladin like really become allies, I guess, in the Way of Kings, where, you know, their bridge crew, you know, their bridge, obviously their bridge four, and they have their skerfuffles. They don't fully get along, but this is like one of those. This is that moment where they are on like chasm duty or their work outside of the bridge crew, and they kind of, it's kind of the big uniting moment, if you will, for Bridge Four. Is Kaladin teaches the kata, and it kind of is. I think it's a moment with Moash that kind of brings him onto the same side, I guess, because Moash is more difficult to get along with. So,
incorrect. But fun fact about that chapter that you're talking about, as all the bridge crew are learning the new kata, Moash is the one who takes to it the fastest, and they have like spheres spread around the chasm to give them light. And Moash casts 9 shadows. Specifically 9 on the chasm wall. So keep an eye out for that when you go up for your reread, Paul.
Yeah.
All right, Elliot, kata.
I think this is a training sequence. I think I'm going to get a few of these details wrong because they all kind of mush together in my brain. But training sequence, I want to say we're down in the chasms when we're doing this. I think they're training. They're like... badgering Kaladin to get involved and he doesn't want to, or they're like, hey, show us how to do this, and he's like, nah, I'm not gonna show you how to do this. And they're like, you don't even know how to do this. And then they finally get him to take up the spear, and he whips out this wicked cool kata with Syl spinning all around him, and they're all just like jaw on the floor. Whoa.
Incorrect. But
what?
I didn't go back and double check that there aren't 2 chapters with this name, which there very well could be. This is in Oathbringer. They have just, this is actually, I lied to you, this is a Adolin chapter. And Adolin, Kaladin, and Azure all figure out that they know the same kata. And they're like, they're in Shadesmar. They've just lost Elokar at the end of part three of Oathbringer. And so they're trying to like blow off some steam, do a kata in Oathbringer. And they all realize, wait, where'd you learn that kata from? Well, I learned it from my swordmaster. Well, I learned it from my swordmaster. And they all figure out, oh, they had the same swordmaster. Interesting. So that's kata.
You dirty devil. Trick
that
question.
Was sneaky. Yeah, that was a
it's
sneaky.
It's not a trick. What do you mean it's a trick question?
Oh, come on.
The you chapter name cannot be a check. Yeah, I did. I do know what I did.
Yeah, you know what you did.
All right. Elliot leads 0-0. Or Elliot is going to lead this question, but it is 0-0. Quote ID, who is talking? They found themselves on a ring of small islands surrounding a whirlpool where, it is said, the ocean drains.
Can I get one more time?
They found themselves on a ring of small islands surrounding a whirlpool where, it is said, the ocean drains.
Who's speaking? This is Hoyd.
Correct. Who's he talking to?
Hoyd is talking to... which therapy session is this?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was good of you to get, because all you had to figure out that it was a story being told.
Yeah.
And then it high probability that it's Hoyd, but who's he talking to?
It's, I don't think this one is the Wander Sail, although it might be. I thought this was a different one that was later. Who's he talking to? I'm going to go Kaladin anyway, even though I kind of think it's not.
It is the Wander Sail.
It is the Wander Sail. Okay.
I would not have gotten that one. I will say it for the record. I would like to voice what my guess was going to be, because I thought it was a rather inquisitive one. And I can't, it would have been another one where I can't remember the exact name, but not Rissen, but her, she always refers to him with some weird term that I don't remember, but her like mentor, if you will. Do you know who her I'm talking
Vistim?
About?
Vistim?
Vistim.
Her
yes.
Bobsk.
And her Babsk. Yes. Yes, that's the word I was looking for. I couldn't remember that, but I thought it was this. I thought it was out on the little islands and stuff, but that, yeah, and then guess. I thought Hoyd was, whenever you mentioned that, I thought Hoyd was talking to Shallan. I thought this may have been the girl who looked up or whatever that chapter is called.
Yeah.
But so I was wrong on both accounts, but I wanted to voice it.
I mean, if you'd guessed Hoyd talking to Shallan, you still would have got the point.
I would not have guessed that. My guess was going to be the Bobsk. But once you mentioned this and we're talking about that, that's when I was thinking about what conversation was this.
Alrighty, Paul, you're going to lead. I'm going to give you a review of a Cosmere book that you have read. You need to tell me what they rated it and what book it is. Ultimately, disappointing. Especially given how much time has passed. My recommendations? Much, much, much less flashbacks. I try to read quotes like as accurately as I can, but in my brain, I just try to correct grammar mistakes anyway, but I try to leave the grammar mistakes in. Sorry. My recommendations, much, much, much less flashbacks. They never added anything to the story. Give the characters more control over the plot. The characters don't drive the plot of this book one bit. The plot itself flings the characters around time and again, like pebbles in a high storm. The big reveal? Boring. And not a huge reveal. On the positive side, Sanderson occasionally writes some brilliant prose. It's still rarer than I'd like for a 1,000-word book. 1,000-word book, by the way, not page, word. 1,000-word book, but it's there. I'd have more to say, but I'm trying to make a flight.
This is a challenging one. Okay, can you read me like the first two sentences? Like, I get the gist. I just need to hear the very beginning again.
Ultimately disappointing, especially given how much time has passed.
Okay. So obviously they were disappointed. I'm not going to talk through this too much because I have thoughts leading a bunch of different ways. This makes me... I'm just going to stick with... I'm really struggling to think through all my flashback stuff. So that was a big thing this reviewer touched on. I'm going to say, I think this is Oathbringer. I think this is Oathbringer, and I think this is a 1 star. I think this is a 1 out of 5 stars.
All right. Elliot?
I'm a little baffled by this one, too, because opens with something like after all this time or whatnot, making it seem like they've been waiting for a long time for like a next book kind of thing. And Way of Kings is not super heavy on the flashbacks, if I recall. There's a bunch. It's part of the story, right? But it's not huge. I feel like Words of Radiance and Oathbringer go more into flashbacks. At least that's my memory of it. But I don't feel like this reader would have kept going. I don't feel like this reader would have gotten to a Rhythm of War or an Oathbringer if they've found the end of the 1,000-word story so boring. Oathbringer seems like a smart guess, but I think I'm going to go Words of Radiance, which just seems impossible. Like how are you bored by Kaladin versus Zeth showdown in the High Storm? But I don't think that he made it to Oathbringer. Yeah. I don't think he made it to Oathbringer. So it's got to be Words of Radiance. And yeah, 1 star, I think, I'm feeling that too.
Okay. This is a 3 out of 5 for Oathbringer.
Oh.
They apparently couldn't get past the 1,000 words of Dalinar flashbacks, which somehow don't add anything to the story. How can you get through Dalinar flashbacks and not give it credence to adding to the story?
I need to say something. I need to, because I'm actually really proud because I thought of this. I thought, no, Oathbringer doesn't make as much sense because I think Oathbringer flashbacks are especially pertinent to the story at hand.
Yeah,
like maybe more so than the others. And I really chose Oathbringer because I was taking it as like, this is a logical fallacy. Like this person's already upset about it and thinks there's not payoff when there is. So I'm just going to go, if it's this many negatives, it might as well be a negative on that too, as far as I think through it. But I think that's hilarious.
That's pretty smart. Yeah, maybe logic is the wrong approach to these.
When in the past, like it's that. Betrayed me on these, so I'm trying a new approach. I could have easily seen it be book 2 or 3.
I would have, if I were guessing this, I probably would have gone Rhythm of War, because they were waiting a long time for it, and the flashbacks didn't add anything. And if there's any book where I would make that argument, I think it would be Rhythm of War. For myself,
because
a lot of the Venli Eshinai stuff, I feel like you've already seen, especially if you're not reading into like the more subtle appearances of, you know, Exendweth and all like the other reveals that we get. But anyway,
the one thing I didn't know was how long between releases. If I knew that maybe I could have made a further educated guess. I stuck with Oathbringer because just listening to the review, I didn't think they would have made it. Or been so disappointed or so upset about flashbacks, making it that far and talking about their 1,000-word book. anyways.
I think my outline is 1,000 words.
Yeah.
Okay. It is 1-to-1. The trivia is going to Elliot first. Elliot, give me another title for Raboniel.
Oh, man. Another title for Raboniel. Ooh, that's a really good question.
Thank you. I made it myself.
It's something that it's relevant. I should know it, but I feel like they don't say the other names for those types of characters all that often. Oh man, I'm blanking. I don't have. It shows up early, and it's like something ominous sounding, because you're like, oh, who's this going to be? They've got such a scary title. I got nothing. I can kind of remember the context around the name, but this time, yeah, this is lame. I don't think I have anything.
Alrighty. Paul, do you have anything?
I have one guess, which I don't think is super correct. I think it's some kind of nickname along the lines of, like, you have the Pursuer. I think it's something along those lines.
Okay.
And I have a thought in my head that I'm 99% sure is wrong, but it's the only guess in my head is, and maybe there's something else that's called this. I'm just going to throw it out there. Mother of Storms. Maybe she's called that.
Incorrect.
I thought about saying, as a side note, thought about trying to be cheap and saying like mother or mom, because isn't she a mom and isn't that a point of the story?
That is, no, I thought that about is a big reveal.
that's like part of daughter. The story. Yeah. And so I was like, mom? She's been called mom by someone. I mean, anyways.
Should I give you guys both another 30 seconds to brainstorm, or are you not going to come up with it?
I'm not going to come up with anything further. If mom isn't an acceptable answer, that was my last one.
Alrighty. So, Elliot, you're correct. When the character is introduced, she's introduced through the point of view of Leshui,
yeah,
who gives her the title Lady of Pain, and she got that title by producing and releasing a, what's the correct, I was going to say pathogen, but that's not the correct term, an epidemic, a virus on the humans. She had created a virus to attack the humans on the last desolation. It didn't really work, but that's how she became the Lady of Pains. She didn't like the title, so she retitled herself the Lady of Wishes, which is what Navani calls her for like half the book, is Lady of Wishes, before she gives her permission to call her Raboniel. So there you go. 1-1, the points are nullified, still 7-5. Moving into next week. Thanks, guys.
Fair enough.
All right. We will be going through Alloy of Law 3, the third episode out of 4 for next week. See you guys then, Paul and Elliot.
See ya.
Bye.